I asked him late yesterday, and he wasn't able to do it. But joining me is the two-thirds of the Earth is covered by water, the other third by Grant Newsham. He joins me now. So, Grant, first of all, good evening to you. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Big movements. I want to ask you about Europe, and we certainly have to talk to Japan about Japan. And so let's start with Japan. What, a week, 10 days ago, Prime Minister Abe announced that he would be stepping down for health reasons. Is that legitimate? Is he a sickly man? He doesn't appear to be so. He's been a pretty robust guy over the last decade or so since he's come on the world stage. So what's going on with Prime Minister Abe?
You know, I'm willing to take it at face value and assume that it is health reasons and that he's just kind of tired out after 8 years. There is one school of thought that there's a few things the prosecutors are interested in regarding him and his administration. And say there's a school of thought that he's leaving to get out of town before the prosecutors show up at the door. I don't know. Because it's probably at the end of the day, however, the important thing is he's gone. Or he will be shortly. One thing that gives some truth to or substance to the claim that the looming scandals is that he did make an effort to try and just a few months ago to keep his favored chief prosecutor in office for longer than the law allows. And that kind of gives you a sense of things. But that said, it's Japan. It's the culture. And probably every prime minister, if the prosecutors wanted him, could go after him. But we'll just say that he stepped down for health reasons. And, after 8 years, he's probably had enough of the job because he's got plenty of enemies.
Got it. So what's going to happen? Explain how this will work. He will step down at the end of his term. He will. I'm embarrassed to say I'm not that familiar with how the Japanese do succession and how they actually do elections and turn over their government. So can you give us a little Japanese civics 101?
I probably understand it a little better than you, but just a little bit. It's a parliamentary system. It's sort of closer to the. It's sort of a combination of our system and the sort of the British system. But Abe, he had about a year to go on his term. So he's stepped down about a year before. And when that happens, they have to find a replacement. And what they're doing, and they're allowed to do it, is they're choosing one from within his party. But the people who will vote on it are basically the very senior party members. It's not like everybody gets to vote, but it's a certain select group of party members. So they're going to get together and vote for one of the three candidates, the three guys who are running, and choose who they want. And kind of everybody already knows what the answer is. So it's a little unusual from our perspective, but by Japanese standards, it's pretty typical. So Abe has announced his intention to step down. Somebody is going to be elected by a small group of his party member or leadership to fill out the remainder of Abe's term. And then after that, I think they have to have like a regular election.
Got it. So who's going to be the guy or the girl? Would they dare nominate a woman?
The day that Washington football team wins the Super Bowl, they would. It's going to be a while. No, there's a few women who would like the job, and one of them's actually kind of qualified. The third one is kind of, she's like a typical kind of corrupt Japanese politician, but in female guise. That's a really long way of saying no. There's about 100% chance this will be a guy. And it's a fella who is, he's currently serving as the chief cabinet secretary, which is like chief of staff for Prime Minister Abe. And his name is Suga. That's his last name. It's Yoshihide Suga. And he is as typical a Japanese politician as you will ever find.
Well, what does that mean? I mean, for those of us who aren't steeped in Japanese politics and culture, what does that mean?
If you took, say, a guy like Dan Rostenkowski or Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago, the first one, these are guys who their whole mindset, their focus is on sort of domestic affairs. And it's not as if they really give a whole lot of thought to policies to make life better for the average citizen. They give a lot of thought to getting themselves reelected and keeping themselves sort of at the top of this sort of power, this sort of mosh pit with guys at the top for power in Japan. And the basic role of the typical Japanese politician is to move government money to favored constituents who in turn move the money, donate the money back to the politician for their election campaign in a sort of cycle. And that's a little cynical, but not by much. And so the guys who are in the Diet who really have some, you know, desire to institute policies that are going to help people, going to help the country, they're actually pretty rare. But really just the kind of guy that, as I said, you know, their thing is staying in power, being somewhere near the top and keeping that money circulating. And that's kind of what you're getting with this fella. And to stay at the top, of course, you've got to be pretty ruthless in the Japanese or really any political world, but right. In Japan, no less than anywhere else. And this guy is ruthless, which doesn't distinguish him from a lot of people. But from our perspective, or you know, people like us who think about foreign affairs and defense matters, a guy like Suga doesn't really give it much thought. You know, in terms of priority, sort of Japan's defense strategy, policy, the state of the JSDF, that's if you took like the lowest priority and then went a little bit lower, that's about where he is. What's going to happen probably is he's going to be told by some of his advisors, oh, don't worry, everything's fine, just keep doing what we're doing. And implicitly, the Americans will take care of things if we have any problems. But don't worry. And so the focus is going to be, once again, on these, what the Japanese refer to as money games, and this sort of effort to keep power. And there's all sorts of rival factions in the Japanese ruling party, in Japanese politics, all of whom are trying to bump you off of the perch. So that's where his focus is going to be. And it's not going to be on improving Japan's defense capabilities. That's my impression. We could always be surprised, and maybe something will force him to take a look at it. But that's what you would normally expect to happen, is a return to this very inwardly looking Japanese political leadership. And Abe was different. You know, he saw foreign affairs, he saw defense as something important and something really necessary for Japan. So this was like an 8-year kind of a interruption from the usual. And you know, we'll see how this goes.
Got it. So what is the top issue for the Japanese? Do they not see the looming dragon on the horizon and understand that might be something that they should probably kind of get their hands around or at least get oriented on? So what's the number one issue in Japan?
It depends on which Japanese you're talking to. Now, there are Japanese within the leadership in the party, the ruling party, that do understand the threat. They do understand the need for a useful defense and a properly aligned sort of Japanese military with the United States, with U.S. forces. But they're kind of a minority, but there's a fair number of them. In the Japanese population, I think most people, probably a vast majority, do understand the importance of defense and foreign affairs when it's explained to them. And plus, there's no love lost with the Japanese populace for the Chinese. Probably 80, 90% of them don't like China. It is about that simple. But if you get into the Japanese political world, you probably find, I'm not saying it's reversed, but you probably find that at least 40, 50% of the Diet, that's their Congress, these guys don't see China as that big a threat. And partly it's because, you know, a whole bunch of them are taking Chinese money or have, you know, gone on study trips to China and come back and, you know, it's girls' money and then blackmail. And, you know, for whatever reason, they have a pretty sort of rosy view of China, don't really see it as a threat. And where it's there's an issue with this new fella is to get all the support he needed to be the shoe-in for this position. There's a fella who has a faction in the ruling party, and his name's Nikai, and everybody knows this. And he's the Secretary General of the Liberal Democratic Party, which is a big deal. And he's, as a Japanese guy put it, and, you know, he's a little joking a little, but he told me just the other day, he says, you know, Nikai is not a Chinese agent. Nikai is Chinese. His point was that Nikai is pretty darn pro-China. And since he gave his support to Suga, so Suga will have enough power or enough votes to get elected, there's some fear that Suga may not be too concerned about things Chinese, at least from it being a problem. So that's a concern. And, you know, it's funny, but Japan is much closer to China than we are in terms of distance and history. And yet you don't, in the political world, in the ruling class, the business class, there's nothing like the fear of China that you think there would be. But though there are plenty of good, what you call patriotic, smart Japanese, including in the political world, who do understand this and would like to do it, but they face opposition. But in the public writ large, that is overwhelmingly ill-disposed towards the People's Republic of China.
All right. So all things will remain even in Japan. And so we will see what the future brings relative to China and if Japan at all changes course. So, but again, the whole key to Japanese succession is no changing anything.
You know, I think it's going to be, at least with Abe, you had a chance. And he was trying to sort of upgrade the military, give it some respect, get it some more money. But he just faced immense opposition. Throughout his 8 years, he did succeed in having the laws changed to allow the Japanese to give more support to U.S. forces and to reinterpret the meaning of collective self-defense. These are commonsensical things so that Japan could actually get involved in its own defense much greater than before if it wants to. But he never succeeded in really increasing the defense budgets, getting the JSDF to be able to do joint operations, either with themselves or with the Americans, except for the two navies. And so that the concrete things you would need to really improve Japan's defense, even he wasn't able to do it. And he was probably the most interested in it of any prime minister there's been for 30 years at least. And the new guy is not going to see that as such a high priority. So we're probably actually going to, slide down a notch in terms of Japanese interest in defense matters and sort of beefing up their capabilities. I'm not too optimistic about that. You know, it is possible something could happen that forces Japan to think otherwise, or the Americans could actually insist on it. But since we've never insisted on anything for 40, 50 years, there's no reason to think we will this time.
All right, let's switch gears. Something just happened over the course of last weekend in the Philippines. There was kind of eyebrow raising. Mr. Duterte is not the greatest friend of America, yet a Philippine court, appeals court, I think, ruled that an American Marine who is guilty of killing a Philippine, I think, prostitute transvestite or transsexual, I'm not sure which one, was recommended that he be allowed out early. And there was an appeal from this person's family, along with a transgender rights group. And so the thing was put on hold. And then President Duterte completely pardoned him, I believe. What do you make of that, Grant?
Well, it was interesting. You know, I don't quite know is, of course, the correct answer, but I'll pretend like I do. I wasn't sure if what Duterte did was the legal process having run its course, where the Marine had served enough of his term to deserve sort of early release or to deserve release under regular procedures, or if Duterte actually sort of did him a favor. But regardless, he's going to get some criticism for this, and from citizens, certain groups, and so you might say that he's sort of trying to ease up a little bit on his attitude towards the United States, and but maybe there may be some limited significance to it, but. Also, you found recently that the defense minister and the foreign minister of Philippine officials have actually made some reasonably strong statements against Chinese behavior. And it could be that, that sort of chunk of the Philippine ruling class that has always been pro-American, that maybe they're, sort of stood up enough or, are moving to sort of force Duterte to kind of ease up towards the United States. So maybe his ruling in this, the court case, maybe that's a reflection of a larger shift or sort of assertion of power by the pro-American part of the Filipino ruling class. I would speculate there may be something to that. Because some of these statements that have been coming out from some of the Philippine leadership have been ones that would, I think, have set off Duterte if they'd been said 2-3 years ago. So maybe that's what's going on. It's certainly, I say that the pendulum has at least stopped shifting towards the PRC. Whether it's shifting back towards us, I'm not sure.
You know what, and I don't know that we need to shift them to shift back to us, but I will tell you this. I mean, when you look at, the Marine Corps' plans, and you look at, the Navy shipbuilding plans, and you get out your Ouija board, and you say, if the Marine Corps, and this is just McNamara talking now, if the Marine Corps thinks that we're going to sneak around with a bunch of smaller ships, I think that's preposterous. I mean, the Chinese militia, the Chinese fishing fleet will be all over those things like a hobo on a ham sandwich. And so there's no freedom of movement. There's no freedom of maneuver with those things. Now, if the Philippines is neutral and allows you to train there, that changes the entire equation. If Vietnam would be leaning towards the United States, which we all know they'd like to, and allow us to get ashore, that's a completely different issue because now you can mask yourself. Now you can do those things if it's a more permissive environment. So, I mean, that's not a small thing. And I don't know that we need them to jump back in our lap again, although I think that at some point they would like to be closer to us if someday Mr. Duterte does go. We just don't need them to lean to the Chinese, and I think that in and of itself is a huge step, and I think that step combined with, Europe's telling the Chinese, yeah, and Huawei not so much in our 5G infrastructure. I think those are big movements in free world versus Chinese. Chinese relations. And so I want to talk about General Dunford for a second, and then I want to go to Europe. Dunford talked about in an article over the weekend in the Boston Globe, and one of the things that the former chairman said was that the United States has to lead, right? And that the free world has benefited tremendously from the world that was set up post World War II. The United Nations, NATO, Bretton Woods Economic Agreement, prominent in all of that. And that has provided a framework for global stability, but it requires strong U.S. leadership. And if the United States won't lead in this realm, who do we cede that leadership to? The Chinese? The Russians? And so, to me, the chairman asked the questions that the free world has to wrestle with, and that, will you bargain that away for greater economic ties with the Chinese? And so, last week, I guess in preparation for Chairman Xi going to Europe later this month or some talks, the Chinese foreign minister was in Europe and did not get the reception that he was looking for, that there was pushback from the Europeans about, you know what, we're not going to be your dancing chicken, and we're not going to be a pawn between you and the United States, and here's what we need. Did you see that reporting, and give me your thoughts on that?
I did see it. I saw the article, in fact, and I didn't know General Dunford was a Southie.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah, I suppose, but makes sense. It's about one of every four Marine officers is. But I would say I think he was a very, very good chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and his behavior after leaving office is even better. But that said, I thought it was a good piece. Just a couple observations is that, you know, I think I've never heard anybody who said, let's throw out these institutions that were founded after World War II. You know, you cited Bretton Woods, but also right. United Nations, World right. Health Organization, all of these sort of international things. And nobody's saying, you know, let's just demolish them. But what this administration did, it's saying, look, you know, we've been a part of these. We've tried to reform these from within. We've stuck around and we've tried to, you know, make these work. And the Chinese have still come in and have subverted them. And even if the Chinese hadn't come in, you have these, you know, these little no account countries that have pretty much taken them over and turned them into almost corrupt patronage sort of operations. And so, maybe the thing to do is to do like we did, say, with WHO, is just, okay, we're leaving and pay for it yourselves. You know, it's we would probably differ on the approach to trying to fix these things. But, you know, I would point out that I'm not aware of anybody who said, you know, America isn't, you know, interested in these, doesn't think they're important, but rather the approach to trying to fix them, I think, would differ. We're losing, you know, with what we were doing. If we, but so maybe sometimes it does take some of the so-called tough love to convince people that you're serious, you know, that you are going to not stop funding it, you're not going to participate in the case of the international court, and we're going to put sanctions on these idiots who, you know, going after Americans. You know, say we just differ a little on that, but certainly the visit of the Chinese diplomats to Europe was pretty interesting. That they did not get anything out of this, and they, in fact, you kind of wish they'd come back for more, given the way the Europeans, you know, laid it, stuck it to them. You know, even the Frenchies, you know, weren't having it, and the Germans have the Germans seem to have woken up a bit and pushed back. The Greeks and the Italians there, it's hard to say, but really this was a disaster for the Chinese. It's and then the Czech, what the president of their Senate and about 60-70 parliamentarians went to visit Taiwan.
Yeah,
that's pretty good. You know, and you know all of this stuff is happening. Under whose administration? It's Mr. Trump's, you know, so sometimes this sort of forceful behavior by the Americans has, maybe given some courage to some of our European friends as well to stand up to China, because they'd never done it before.
Right. And the article was in Bloomberg. It was an opinion piece. The headline is, Europe just declared independence from China as the EU navigates an increasingly Sino-Soviet world. Is it Sino or Sino?
I think Sino is what the, you know, us Rhodes scholars
use. The elites, is that what you elites use it?
Yeah, me and William F. Buckley.
It finally sees the need to stand together, even against Beijing. And there's a couple of interesting. So Mr. Wang Yi is the foreign minister, and he went to Europe. Wang showed up hoping to hear softer tones to which he's accustomed from Europeans who remain more eager than the Americans to keep trading and doing business with China. Instead, he was surprised at the amount of resistance he was picking up under the formal niceties. But those dissonances were nothing compared to his stopover in Berlin. Now, I'm one of the biggest critics of the Germans. They are Russia's enabler on the continent, and I see them as really something that keeps NATO from being something special and more stable. Speaking to German reporters, Wang lashed out at the president of the Czech Senate, Milos, and Grant was just talking about him, Verstrel, who had taken a delegation to visit Taiwan. Visceral would pay a heavy price, threatened Wang, fuming that the Czech betrayal made him an enemy of 1.4 billion Chinese people. This elicited a prompt response from Heiko Maas, Germany's foreign minister, standing next to Wang in their joint press conference. Maas reminded his visitor that, quote, we as Europeans act in close cooperation and demanded respect, and that threats don't fit in here, that the EU would not become the plaything of Sino-American rivalries, he added. Colleagues from France, Slovakia, and other European countries quickly backed him up. So, again, stunning, I think stunning news, because we have not seen this type of independent behavior and this pushback on the Chinese, who honestly believe that you know, their boa constrictor will act as the kraken for the world's black pearl. And this discussion came out of Military Times wrote an article about war with China based on a DOD assessment that got released, I don't know, maybe 10 days ago. And that's what kind of brought up a separate discussion relative to the Philippines and the South China Sea and whatnot. And so let me ask you that, Grant. Do you see the Chinese and the United States in any kind of shooting event on the horizon?
It's not unthinkable. And, you never quite know exactly how these things play out or what the cause of it is. You know, it's often something you don't expect. It's often something that in retrospect doesn't seem like that big a deal. But I think it's definitely on the menu, of potential events, things that might happen. You say, well, we're ever going to fight Greenland. You know, you could pretty much say no, or fight Canada, probably not. But with China, that's something, it's definitely a possibility. This is in dangerous times. And you look at not just us, you look at the Chinese scuffling with the Indians. Their just long-standing desire to teach the Japanese a lesson. When they promised that they are going to take Taiwan, and we might as well take them at their word on that they could at least try. And you throw us into the mix, and we have an interest in all of these places, and it's not hard to think of something happening that draws us in or that happens to us directly. You can think of any number of scenarios, where China's just, mad as hell, and they're not going to take it anymore. Or they just, for whatever reason, they want to teach the Americans a lesson, they're going to do it. And, a drunk in a South Boston bar at 1 a.m. Talking himself into a fight.
That never leads to good things.
you know, so stuff.
Now, let me ask you this. I would point this out as an amateur economist. I thought Russia, who we coexisted with for the better part of 60 years, was more susceptible to going to war because there was the asymmetry of our economy versus Russia's economy, and Russia conscious of that. Russia's economy, what, the size of Canada, South Korea, Texas, okay? And so that asymmetry, I think, always had the Russians on edge that, yay, we call ourselves our equal, but you know what? We're really not, and we know it. The Chinese, though, don't suffer from that. And so because of their robust economy, why would they risk such a fight with the United States? To lose.
Because they think large part, I think they can win.
Really?
You know, if you teach the Americans a lesson, knock them back, humiliate them, and demonstrate that China's the sort of the force of the future, and you'll have people getting in line to cut their deals with the Chinese, and, you know, that's where they want to be. It's where they think they belong. As dominating the world, and you know that would be a reason. If you thought you could get away with it, you know, and sort of smack the Americans and cause them us to back off and to lose. You know, and losing doesn't necessarily mean we surrender in ceremony at the Capitol, but simply we get pushed out of Asia where we cannot operate anymore for fear of getting hammered by the Chinese. And if we're pushed out, then it will be clear that we can't defend any of our friends and anyone who's counting on us. And they, you know, there's a psychological aspect to this. And if it looks like we're the losers and the Chinese are the stronger power, you know, turning out 4 warships for every one of ours over the last decade with many more ships than we've got already, you know, it looks like they're the strong guy. Well, we're in trouble. And the Chinese just might see it that way. And, of course, the sort of domestic events in China might affect that, where they might see that, you know, if they have, you know, economic trouble or domestic unrest or an unsettled sort of circumstances, that they just might see that as a good way to distract attention. And, once again, if you throw in, you know, you might even beat the Americans, I don't think it's all that unthinkable from a Chinese perspective. And plus there's some questions like an anthropologist could probably answer better, someone who really understands the Chinese, is that desire to dominate, as you see it in business and in just in the way that Chinese deal with counterparts in business, government, military, et cetera, when they think they have the advantage. There's no real sort of benefit or sort of a good sort of, there's nothing positive from their perspective about letting the other guy off the mat. You really want to finish him off. And at most just let him, give him a little breathing space, but to dominate is the Chinese thing. And there's that expression that in Chinese, it's like you die, I live. And we don't quite have that. You know, we're more of handshake kind of guys and, you know, split the difference. You know, right. What's it going to cost me to put you into this Ford Fairlane? You know, that kind of, you know, we're those sorts of people, not so much the Chinese. And speaking generally, I would, you know, you go to Taiwan and it's almost a different sort of Chinese. But say mainland Chinese of a certain sort, right? Particularly the Communist Party as well. So. But I think that they'd do it if they thought they could get away with it.
And now, I think it's interesting. I don't know that I agree with you, but I find your assessment interesting, always intriguing. Another. It's amazing the news since we last spoke. But another story today in the Wall Street Journal, and actually it was yesterday, and it talked about. The island nation of Palau offering the United States basing rights, airbase, and port facilities. Now, you sensitized me to this, talking about how the Chinese were all over the Pacific. They were offering, you know, essentially the island version of the Belt and Road Initiative in exchange for deeds, and the United States had to get in the business of pushing back on this. That to me does not look like a small event.
It's not. I would find the U.S. ambassador to Palau, and I'd slip him an extra 20 in his pay packet this week. This is a big deal. And it really, you know, I don't know who's to thank, but I have a feeling the ambassador had something to do with it. He really deserves some credit for this, and it's what ambassadors should be doing, not just writing reports of what's going on, but, you know, shaping the environment. And this is a big deal. The ambassador used to be the political advisor at Marfor PAC, in fact.
Oh, do you know
so
him?
I'm acquainted with him, and, you know, I'm not entirely surprised that something useful came out of this. But it is a big deal. You know, to any time a country anywhere, and particularly in real strategic terrain, offers you the opportunity to come in and set up facilities and use them as much as you please, the more the better. That's a big deal. And especially since we've been kind of getting back-footed and pushed around
right.
in a lot of these Pacific nations. I think Kiribati, where Tarawa is a recent example of that, Solomon Islands last year. So it's really nice to have a key small country actually welcome us in. And it is very interesting. I think part of it has to do with the existing and recent Palauan leadership they've recognized Taiwan. Palau is actually pretty well disposed towards Japan. And there's also a connection with the U.S. and even a bit with the Marines, as I understand it. But what happened is about 2015 or 16, the Chinese sort of started sending tourists to Palau in huge, huge numbers. It was like doubled the total number. And that doubling was Chinese tourists. And that comes in and, you know, they buy up or lease real estate and buy up hotels and build hotels, et cetera. And the locals don't really benefit from it at all. You do create a class in the Palauan society that sees the Chinese as the important country because they're making money from the Chinese tourists. But the president said, you know, I don't want this. You know, this is just too many of them, and they're taking over the place, and they're splitting our society. And so he basically changed the law to cut down the number of tourists who are visiting, something like that. But also the Chinese, I'm told, PRC, tried to put pressure on him to de-recognize Taiwan and switch to the PRC. He said no. So the Chinese cut off the flow of tourists to Palau, thinking that that would be punishment because they're not getting tourist dollars. And the president of Palau and, you know, enough of the ruling class kind of said, you know, that's okay. We'll find more good tourists, more who spend more money. And the Americans have been at work. And you'll recall that the president of Palau and Micronesia and I think Marshall Islands, they all visited the White House last year
right.
or so, and President Trump met them. And that's the first time that's ever happened. So this administration has paid attention to those islands, and this is the payoff. And they say it is some good work by a lot of people. I don't know exactly, probably not a lot of people. It's probably just a few people who saw what's important and went out and did something. Now the test is if we're going to take advantage of it, and these are fast. And I hope we do. And it's up to, you know, if we don't, we're making a huge mistake. You know, it's very interesting that about 10 years ago, the Americans were offered something similar. It was offered more quietly down sort of in the Indonesia area. And the U.S. military, the Marines included, could not get their act together to take advantage of it, even though, of course, the captains and a few captains and majors actually put together a perfect plan for getting in, setting up some training areas and using them. But that our ruling class level, they let that slip. And now the Chinese have got their fangs into this small little country down Indonesia way. So hopefully we do take advantage of this one. And it's a big development. You know, we'll see how it goes. And sometimes when you have success, say in one place, it can open up opportunities elsewhere. You know, if you think about it, because if we actually get down there and start doing things that, you know, it shows a real interest, a commitment, and maybe other countries will take advantage of it, particularly in the island states. But something that's important is if the U.S. government is smart, it's going to somehow get U.S. business or even Taiwanese business, Japanese business interested in this effort and, you know, get them in there, subsidize if necessary or guarantee the investments. So make it more than just the military showing up, but rather a sort of attack on some broad fronts and show people that if you link up with the Americans, good things happen. And we're not going to take your country. This is pretty good. It was good news.
If you, honestly, so it's been a string of some pretty amazing pushback worldwide on the Chinese. If you were to cast, I'm looking at the map that goes with the Wall Street Journal, the Wall Street Journal's article. And if you were to cast an eye and say, okay, in the region, the next, I want you to tell me the implications of the Palau deal, and tell me if you believe what you believe to be the next biggest priority. Does that make sense? I'm stammering here, but the next big priority. For this, what would you think it would be? What nation do you think it would be? In agreement with who?
That's a good question. I would like to improve our presence in, I call it the Central Pacific, but I think it's referred to as the Northern Pacific, the Micronesia, the Federated States of Micronesia.
Right.
I think we could do a lot more to have a sort of a useful military presence there. But once again, you've got to get the economic thing in right as well. You know, and so that's, if you look at the map, and this is really the heart of our defenses in the Pacific. And if you're not there, well, someone else is going to be.
Right.
And that has been the case. And it's, you know, I think the expression benign neglect was actually coined, I think, referring to, I think it was Federated States of Micronesia, that, you know, we have a relationship with the place that prohibits, you know, we have a veto on foreign militaries using their territory. And we give them huge amounts of money for infrastructure and education mostly. But the Chinese have come in and for 30 years have very effectively insinuated themselves into these islands, economically, commercially, diplomatically. And while we're paying the rent, this other country, you know, the Chinese have come in and built up a lot of influence. We sort of make everyone eat their vegetables, or we pay for their vegetables, and the Chinese come in, give everyone like ice cream cones, and they're the cool guys. I would like to think Micronesia is a place we would pay more attention, just like we have with Palau. And Marshall Islands, you do need to keep an eye on it because the political subversion, Chinese subversion, is ongoing and has been for forever. And as mentioned, Kiribati has just switched to recognition from Taiwan to China. And that the strategic location is a concern. But as the Kiribati leadership pointed out, well, what choice did we have? You know, who else offers us anything? So it's, you know, for the amount of money that you cost to put on a Marine Corps ball, you could pretty much ensure we do more to promote our interests in some of these places. But I would, if I had to pick one, I think it would be Federated States of Micronesia. And of course, Taiwan's always there, but there's different pieces of the puzzle that if you lose any one of them or any combination, you've really got a problem. Taiwan alone, lose that and you have trouble. The Philippines, as we talked about, once again, you look at the map and that plugs up, that's right on the first island chain. So if you lose those, you know, it's not good news. But given the opportunity, the lack of effort to date, I think it's FSM is what I would go for.
Got it. The you wrote a piece. I just think it's very interesting as this thing moves around the world, whether COVID happened or not. I think it's interesting. The gyrations in terms of relationships with China. I want to go to Australia. Australia is, if you read Australian-Chinese relations, you'll see things written like on the verge of breaking. Talk to us about the latest developments in that. It seems like more and more awkward. What, Australian journalists being expelled from China? What's the latest on that and why on the verge of breaking?
The Australians have probably 3 years ago, they woke up very quickly and realized that they were like being devoured by this Chinese python or strangled, take your pick, but they eventually eat you. But because you had Chinese influence, just brazen influence in the government and academia, and the business world was being taken over. There's huge Chinese investment and acquisitions, and you had a lot of Australian business and politicians who saw that being able to sell stuff to China was, you know, was essential. Australia couldn't survive without it. But finally, the Australians woke up and they suddenly put the brakes on all of this. And have passed some laws and changed policies and just started talking about the Chinese threat and dealing with it. And they haven't stopped. And these have been what you would call conservative governments who've done this. But there's pretty much this broader support for it than that. So this has caused the Chinese to be kind of angry, and they put on some economic sanctions, none of them legitimate. They've done that. They've also verbally have just been abusive of the Australians, and it's even gotten even worse after the Chinese virus broke out. Because the Australians said, well, let's find out where this came from, and that set off the Chinese, the People's Republic of China's government, and they've tightened up some of the economic pressure. It's, you know, barley, this is 80% tariffs on that. Wine, Australian wine is under investigation. They can't sell it in China or such like.
Right.
They just recently took an Australian citizen of Chinese origins who was a reporter for a Chinese TV, I believe. They took her hostage under trumped-up charges. And just the other day, as you mentioned, there were two Chinese Australian journalists who were, I think, on the verge of being taken hostage as well in China. But they were able to apparently get word to their embassy quick enough. The embassy put them under protection and was able to get them out of the country. But if the embassy hadn't been quick on their feet, that I think you'd have a couple more Australians hostage, just the way the Chinese have taken hostages with the Canadians. We've got some Americans too, and Indians and other countries. And the Australians are showing no signs of backing down, which is really to their credit. So that's really a long way. And I would note that the Australians were the first ones to wake up, and we came along sort of after that. But they did a good job on it. But like a lot of these things, it depends on if you can keep it going for a while, or if you just lose interest or gets too tiring, or business lobbies give you trouble, or a new administration comes in and, you know, wants to hit the reset button with the Chinese. And you never quite know. But so far, it's a far cry from what it was in 2015. when everybody, you know, was doing their best to get their snout into that trough of Chinese money. And you couldn't even sit in, you know, the military guys, too, were, you know, angling to engage with China, that you couldn't even call them an adversary. So this is a, it is different than it was. And, you know, as you noted, you know, go around the world and point out a country that is China's real friend. And I don't think there is one. Maybe Cambodia and Laos, but I don't even think the North Koreans are their friends. But if they are, that's not, it's not a whole lot.
Right.
And it's even worse for the Chinese today. You know, how do you make friends? And so once you've irritated, you know, you've alienated a lot of people, and you've shown what you really think of them with your language and your behavior. So I think there's a lot of places that are leery. And if you were to, it's the only thing that that works for China is when they throw money into places and into people's bank accounts.
All right. Yeah, no, the topics, the hits just keep coming, right? If I was a 1960s radio DJ. You wrote a piece, was published on Monday, entitled How the U.S. Should Deal with Japan's Next Leader. How should the United States deal with Japan's next leader? And what do we want from Japan?
We want them, you know, I'm just a broken record, is we want a Japan that has a useful military, one useful to themselves, but also useful to us. You know, this defending Asia, defending Northeast Asia, it requires a solidly linked U.S.-Japan military sort of alliance with a capable Japanese military. And except for the Japanese Navy, we do not have that. And the Japanese, nobody has been a bigger supporter than me, but the JSDF is, except for the Navy, is pretty much useless. And I'm sure you'll hear lots of harumphing, you know, from the audience, but, you know, show me the war stocks, show me that radio with which the three services can talk to each other. Show me their logistics plans. How about their mobilization plans? And then where's that headquarters in Japan where the Americans and the Japanese get together and coordinate their defense? Or is the plan just to wing it if something happens? So you can see I've got some concerns. So that's what we need, you know, from the Japanese, because certainly under Abe, they've been very supportive politically of what the Americans have been trying to do. And even, you know, on the economic front, the sanctions front, they have been helpful. And, you know, but on the military end, you've got to pull your weight at the end of the day, because it is, as noted, it is feasible, possible that we just might end up in a fight in the region. And you're not going to win if the Japanese aren't helpful and doing a lot more than they can. And you're certainly not going to deter it if things stay like they are.
Right.
The balance is just shifting too much. So, and that's just on the defense front. So we got to have them, you know, get better and spend a lot of money on their own defense and stop missing their recruitment targets by 25% every year, because nobody much wants to join because you live like serfs. And to get that done, you can't just ask the Japanese to please do it.
Right.
As we've been trying to do that, that's what we've done. You know, we don't want to be overbearing. We're the, we're the United States, and, you know, come on, you know, we really need you to do this. And we've done that, and look how well it's worked out. You've heard what I've just described. So right. How successful has that been over the last 60 years? I would say not very much, but even worse, you will often find U.S. officials on both sides who refuse to speak clearly to the Japanese of what we need. And instead, they will often think of reasons why the Japanese can't do something. And you hear it all the time. Oh, it would be too hard for them politically, or they have an election coming up. We don't want to embarrass them. You know, it's just one excuse after another. And exactly whose interests are these officials supposed to be representing? I would suggest ours, not the Japanese. And so what we need to do, and what the article says, and I refer to the story of how the Americans got USS Midway into Yokosuka around 1970. And the point is, when there's something that we really need, it's tell the Japanese what we need and don't back down. But the Japanese have played us very well, and they know that we will back down, assuming we even speak up in the first place.
Right.
But that needs to change. So, you know, I think so that it's pretty simple, but we have room to excel in that area.
All right. So we want them to, but they have to be able to see that what's going on in the South China Sea is coming to the East China Sea. How do they overlook that? You're the one that told me, I know within the last couple of months that there is more Chinese maritime activity near the Senkaku Islands than ever before, and it increases on a monthly basis. And you laid out a scenario where at some point somebody's going to have engine trouble and go ashore and never going to leave. I think that was the little scenario you put out there for us. That can't be lost on them. And how do they see a minimally militarized Japan being able to guarantee their own existence next to the python or the boa constrictor?
Good question. the Japanese Navy knows very well that they're getting outmatched.
Right.
And the Japanese military knows that. And in the political world, there's people who know it as well. In the Japanese version of the commentariat, there are people who understand this too and want to do something about it. But in that ruling class and the business class, at best, they just want to ignore the problem, hope it goes away, or hope the Americans take care of it. And that's actually kind of a Japanese approach to dealing with potentially serious problems, whether it's medical care or what have you, is to not think about it. And also the Japanese don't like being criticized or embarrassed. So that's even more reason to do nothing and, once again, hope the Americans do something about it. And it's really only been from about 15, 20 years ago that there's been a sense of the looming danger from China. So for all these years, there was a belief that Japan didn't face any security challenges, that it could count on the Americans for everything. In fact, the bigger concern was that Japan would be dragged into one of America's wars. Now the concern is that the Americans won't defend them. over some rocks, so which is sort of a nice, I must enjoy the schadenfreude there. But then you do get, however, in the business community and in the Japanese political world, a slice of it, and maybe a bigger slice than we like to think, that actually wants to just acquiesce to Chinese pressure. And because it's going to upset business, upset money flows and it's in just too much trouble, and you might have a war. Who knows? So, we do think that we always tend to think the Japanese will fight to defend every inch of Japan like a Texan would if Mexico threatened like a square foot of something. But not necessarily. I think there is a possibility that if the right circumstances, the right people in charge, Japan just might say, let's talk about it. We're gravely concerned, but we're just going to talk about it. We're not going to fight. So there's a few competing points of view involved when it comes to the Chinese threat. And the Chinese are pretty good at understanding all this. And I think that when the time is right, they'll make their move. We'll see how that goes.
Interesting. All right. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you that's going on relative to Pacific Rim security that you care to comment on? Anything?
What is it? I think one interesting development, it's no reason you would have asked, is Australia. Is the Americans and the Australians have... Somebody's throwing a lot of money into the Northern Territories, up in Darwin and that province.
Right.
And it's like they're going to invest like $1 billion into, I think, the Tyndall Air Force Base. Up there, there's a strategic fuel reserve that's going to go in Darwin. And these are joint Australia-U.S. Efforts. And it does seem like more is being done up in that area to build up the defense infrastructure and even make the training ranges into even better places, you know, not just big empty places, but big places with the technology that you need to really make them pretty good. And that's sort of an interesting sign. You did mention Palau. That's is a big deal. And, you know, at the same time, of course, you have, Chinese subversion in Tonga. If you could look at the map, that's like farther down to the right. And that's, it's splitting a society. You know, and we have one of the things you do note in Chinese efforts is they've kind of put a bet on every single horse, see if one pays off. So they do tend to be everywhere, and we have to maybe we can't be everywhere, but we can't ignore anywhere at least. So we got to figure out a way to deal with that. And I would note Alaska deserves special mention. We don't talk about it much because it's cold up there. But it's I'd like to see, the Chinese know about the Arctic. They've classified themselves as a near Arctic nation. And even though there is no such thing under international law, so there really isn't. And they're throwing their weight around and increasingly up there. And it'd be good if the U.S. military and the Marines have a role up there. It would pay a good bit of attention to Alaska. There's no reason you couldn't set up actually a small amphibious base up there and do all sorts of training in warmer weather and colder weather and amphibious operations as well. It'd be really easy to do. And it's, I think it'd be worth a look. But say it's, when we do think of Asia, we don't think of Alaska so much or that the Arctic, but maybe that should be part of it. It always helps to look at the whole map. So there's a few ideas.
All right. Tell everybody where they find how the U.S. should deal with Japan's next leader. Where did you publish that?
That's in Asia Times. So if you type in my name and Suga, S-U-G-A, and then Asia Times, it'll pop right up. And it's a really good story about Midway. I'm told you don't use the for Navy ships. So about Midway getting into Yokosuka in 1970, because it's all thanks to a U.S. Navy lieutenant commander who deserves the credit. And as part of that, the advice that the Japanese were given, the Americans were given by the Japanese, is just perfect. You know, and we just choose to ignore it. And it's when you need something, tell us what you want and don't back down. Tell us clearly. You know, we're not mind readers. And it's 50 years ago. The advice is as good as it's good then, good now as it was then.
All right. Grant, first of all, I appreciate you doing this. I contacted Grant at the last minute, and he is very gracious. So, as always, very educational, and it's very interesting watching the world gyrate relative to China. And I don't know if we've reached or are reaching kind of a tipping point when the whole world kind of looks at China and says, yeah, we're not going to all turn around and play by your set of rules. So, but I think, I'm not sure if that will ever happen, but I think if it's going to happen, we're a step closer because you see more and more nations, you know, not wanting to play the emperor's new clothes anymore, which I find very, very interesting.
Yes.
All right, sir. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Have a pleasure. Great... Yeah, I always enjoy it. Brimming with resentment. easy to fill up an hour.
All right. Thank you, Grant. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.